right on, Mahalo's DJ Shoots, for that wonderful transition into this Out of the Box special. You're going to be here for the next 2 hours listening to your community radio. We've got a couple of phone-in requests, some guests calling in from the mainland. For sure, we're expecting after the 5 o'clock hour, Dr. Emily Marquez from the Pesticide Action Network of North America, as well as in the booth, Howard Hurst from the Malahia Group, and Howard is also a teacher at Waimea Canyon Middle School. Coming here as a private citizen, concerned citizen, we're going to be following the story of the pesticides on the west side and all over this island. That's a concern to many of us. We're also going to be talking a little bit about the bill 2491 and also this Mana March that's coming up on Sunday, September. I want to say the 8th, because Monday the 9th is the next, what are we calling that, a committee meeting to hear more public testimony supporting and opposing the Bill 2491 relating to GMO technology and pesticide spraying all over this beautiful land. But before we go there, I've got something I got to just let y'all know.
As the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation, five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty, in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people, for many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. And they have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution. And staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. And this will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
There you go, free at last, free at last. We're commemorating 50 years from that August 28th, 1963. I got a big, long list of things to kind of cover right now, but I want to welcome my guest from Howard. Where's home for you?
I'm originally from...
Oh, hold on. There we go. We got to bump up my mic levels here. One more time, Howard. Where's home?
I'm originally from Babylon, Long Island. I've been living on the island of Kauai for 18 years.
Wow, so you're an island boy from a long time back.
Yeah, one island to another.
Right on. And you're a teacher at Waimea Canyon Middle School?
I am. I've been teaching there also for 18. I'm actually a recruited Felix special ed teacher.
Oh, terrific. Working with some of our more, if you will, lovable and challenging students in the special ed field.
Character. They're all, I love the character.
Yeah, and they help build character for us as well as we try to guide them through the hoops of life. 17 years, you were recruited. How long out of college were you? Because you're still a young man. How long out of college were you when you started teaching at Waimea Canyon Middle School?
I had worked for a while. I did 6 years inner city, New York. Mm-hmm. I was surfing Far Rockaway, Long Island. Mm-hmm. Kind of got sick of wetsuits and bullets coming through the windows. I came out here surfing and just liked it, and on a chance wanted to check out salaries. And next thing I knew, they said, "Well, we have a recruiter coming by, and you know, you can meet them up in Albany, of all places," which mm-hmm. is about 5 hours upstate New York. And I was hired. I was kind of worried I wouldn't be able to find the recruiters. And then I went into this hotel that they were at, and they were the people wearing the Aloha shirts. So
they stood
wasn't
up.
Hard. Yeah.
There you go. And brought you in. Did you go straight to Waimea Canyon School, or did you kind of jump through some of the DOE hoops?
You were given a choice of islands.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly, I'm actually from West Babylon. Then before moving here, I lived 12 years in the west end of Long Beach. And when I came to Kauai, I'm a West Sider.
Yeah, there you go.
Waimea. I rarely get past the Hanapepe River. So.
Uh-huh. Well, thanks for venturing all the way over to this side of the island. You know, not an easy thing to do, especially after class today, just to kind of like meander through the traffic in Puhi and through Luhui and see the agro development going along the different ways.
I think I actually found the new surf break. I saw a guy with a truck with Utah plates and he had all boards in the back. I was like, whoa, I didn't know Utah had waves.
So. Oh, there we go. It wasn't a beat old Toyota, was it?
I forget. That's my truck.
Yeah. There we go. Well, thanks for joining us. I know that, you know, we reminisced about the first time you were here, here on KKCR's Out of the Box. Me and Katie Rose were doing an interview.
I appreciate you, you know, having me back. Mm-hmm. It was Marie Mogere and I. It's hard to believe it was so many years ago.
Yeah, it is hard to believe that 7 years ago. And for listeners that might be new to the island or maybe 7 years ago were preoccupied with other stuff going on in their lives, what happened 7 years ago that brought you and Marie up here to KKCR to talk story?
Well, if I could just begin and kind of give the disclaimer that I am here today talking as a private citizen.
Sure.
Although I am a teacher, I would like to share the teacher's side. Our union president, Willa Kobe, provided this testimony statement to all the teachers, and I'd like to share it with you guys if you can give me a minute here. So Hawaii State Teachers Association is the exclusive representative of more than 13,500 public and charter teachers statewide. I'm kind of amending it a bit. HSTA believes in the halt of the use of any pesticides or herbicides that have proven to pose a threat to the health of the island residents and that no exemptions be permitted for any reason. The HSTA further believes that an independent agency should test every school's water and soil for chemical pollutants and that those findings should be made public. Teachers, as well as the public, cannot speculate on how pesticides and other toxic chemicals may affect the wellness, health, and safety of our students. Therefore, it is crucial that the school community be notified of the product being used, location, and the date of the application prior to its use. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and support Bill 2491. That's Willa Kobe.
Mm-hmm. And he's the union,
he's
union
the president.
Chief?
He's the president, union president. So that's HSTA's official stand. Right. They're in support of 2491.
Someone today, when I was mentioning our show and who my guests were and what your background was, she was like, "Well, gosh, what does the union have to say about that?"
Yeah, and that's
it's good
what,
to know that the union.
That's what
is,
prompted them sending that out because so many teachers were inundating the local union rep, and he just sent it out. So it was very reassuring. There's been a couple of efforts since 2006 to get to where we are, many of the same hopes and visions that this current 2491 is asking for. There was 3170, Senate Bill 3170, which was also for buffer zones around schools, and 2278 was Mel Raposo's effort to get money in order to do a study to find out what was going on out at the school. I did want to, before I begin, touch on the unique perspective that I have as a teacher. One of the things that prompted me to contact you, Jimmy, and revisit this issue is the polarization of sides, the red, the blue shirts. Mm-hmm. And as a teacher, I have students of parents from both sides, particularly from the west side. In 2000, when the Kekaha Mill closed, we actually stopped teaching, and many teachers stepped out and watched the parade of old cane trucks and drive by. And it was an incredibly solemn moment. And as a teacher, you really are connected to the community, unlike many other professions. When the children's parents don't have jobs and they come in hungry, you're aware of it.
Right.
And you need to address that. And I have a great respect for all of the parents that do work for these companies, and great empathy for the challenge and heart-wrenching emotions that this whole issue has brought about. When the Kamakani Mill closed in 2009, we even saw a more increase in the free and reduced lunch. To become a Title I school, you have to have a certain percentage of students that qualify for free and reduced lunch. It's a very good litmus test for the economic health of a community.
Right.
And one of the sort of foisted beliefs of this industry is that how they've brought in so much employment out to the west side particularly. And if you look at the free and reduced lunch percentages, which is on the internet, it's free to anyone, it's not private FERPA protected information, you will see that not only has that not happened, but those numbers have increased, the free and reduced lunch, not just at the West Side schools, but around the entire island.
Right.
Now, we know the economy's down and low. However, if there's a multinational global conglomerate stating that they are coming here as saviors to your community and they are offering all this employment, then you would see a change in that percentage. You would see some change in that percentage. And again, from my heart, I'll share a brief anecdotal where a student of mine who I had, as a special ed teacher, I have a unique also opportunity to work with children through 6th, 7th, and 8th grades. Mm-hmm. I'm a middle school teacher, where most teachers see them one period, one grade, and then they move on.
Mm-hmm.
So I really grow with them, particularly through such a formidable time of their lives,
sure.
Middle school. Developmentally, it's an incredible time of their lives. Some people call it middle school madness because the hormones, everything's going.
Yeah.
It's as I said, character. It's a lot of fun. But what this one student who I know had a very hard early life, and I spent the 3 years with him. Just recently, I was down Salt Pond whipping, and I hear this motorcycle come, you know, coming up to me, and I turn, and there's this, you know, dirt bike rider guy in brand new helmet and boots and, you know, beautiful bike, and I can't tell what it is. He's coming at me, you know, and revving up next to me, and I was like, oh, boy, here we go. What's up, man? You know, I'm using the wrong Suji or something. So he pulls his helmet off, and it was that student. And I was, you know, I know where he came from and, you know, often wore the same clothes every day and would have difficulty getting the lunch, even though free and reduced. It's they need the card to get the lunch. And sometimes children come in hungry quite a bit. And this child who's now a young man was just, he had just changed so much and was so happy with himself and his life. And the fact that he was able to provide for himself now. And even provide for some of his family members. And he works for the seed company. And for me, it really brought home the importance of that side of it. Mm-hmm. And listening to some of the testimony, you know, to hear, you know, to have to feed your children, to pay your mortgage, that many people that have come on to this issue really seem to not understand the gravity of that. And I think the council members are so brave to be addressing this issue, and I would not want to be one of them to have to make that decision. With that said, there's also been testimony by people that have worked for the cane companies. I believe one gentleman made a statement that of the 200 people that worked with him, 20 were hired. This one student that I'm referring to, I cannot share another or a list of students, a list of children, a list of families that I'd like to say are all employed by these companies.
Mm-hmm.
During a recent sign waving for blue shirts through Hanapepe. Now, I've been in the community for about 18 years, and we're a very small, tight community. Going through this crowd of individuals holding up signs, I didn't recognize anyone. You know, and I was later to find out that they were actually, many of them brought in from other places, some even other islands.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of clouds the issue and the truth of it. And I'd like to kind of talk about that today.
Yeah.
There's been a number of incidents in Hawaii. November 6th, Waimea Canyon Middle School was one of the first. May 07, Kahuku Intermediate High School. January 8th, Waimea Middle School again. February 8th, St. Joseph's Elementary in Waipahu. March 8th, Highlands Intermediate School, Pearl Ridge. April 8th, Kekaha Elementary and St. Teresa's School. I'll touch on the local ones a bit more.
Sure, but we're talking about Oahu primarily and Kauai.
Well, those are the ones that have been reported.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly and scarily, you know, when ours was reported, it immediately, before children were even out of the hospital, there was a news story about it being stinkweed, that mm-hmm. it was this stinkweed that caused it. And it's taken this long in the state study to dispel that myth, that the state study has data that proves that the chemicals emitted from Cleome Giandra are actually found in all of the control sites within a standard deviation. So it's insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
So many people that I met that are just coming on board, they're really not familiar with the way that things played out. It is not just Oahu and Kauai. It is Molokai. It is Big Island. And around the state, people are organizing and they're raising concern that this off the cuff, well, we follow the label, well, people are getting sick. Even if you are following the label, even if you are doing what you feel is the best practice that is on the mainland, it might not be applicable here in Hawaii because of our unique climate, our microclimates. You cannot say tit for tat. And,
right.
And that's kind of how it was with the corn, too. When they first came in, it was like cane for corn. And everyone said, well, okay, that's the same. Whereas sugarcane, they sprayed, I believe it was twice over a two-year period. And with the GMO, GE corn, they spray multiple applications in a day, two times a week, sometimes three times a week.
Right.
It really depends on what the strain is and what their plan is.
Right.
Through disclosure, lawyers are working on some cases around the island. It's not just advocates for children like myself. But they were able to find out that on on this island, particularly on Kauai, the east side fields are parent fields. And the west side fields, they're all GE test crop fields. So with that said, when they're testing those GE test crops, they're also testing applications. They're testing different mixes of pesticides, different combinations. And when I found that out, and if you have time to go look at a Google map and type in Waimea Canyon Middle School, and you will see the ag lands right next to adjacent building T and the campus with children of developmental middle age from 10 to 13, reproductive development age. And to even think that they're testing these unknowns so close to children, it's pretty horrific. It really is. It's shameless. It's just that they would do that.
Mm-hmm.
The first incident that occurred November 6th at Waimea Canyon Middle, as a surfer, you're always looking at the winds and seeing what's going to go down. And a fellow teacher, also a surfer, and I were standing out there, and we noticed they had the spray machines out in the field. Prior to that, there had actually been an incident. I had filed a complaint with the Department of Ag in 2004. I had had an aquaculture program outside of T Building, and I was raising golden tilapia.
Mm-hmm.
We had an 800-gallon tank, a 300-gallon tank, and 400-gallon horse troughs. They were all filtered with the same UV sterilizer and an airlift charcoal filtration system. When the Kekaha mill closed down, that field went fallow, and it was then subsequently leased by Monsanto. And after a spray application right on the onset by Monsanto, I came in one morning and all my fish were dead, floating.
Wow.
All except the ones that were in the 800-gallon tank, which were my adult brood stock. And those fish, it became a parts per million sort of thing, you know, where all the fry died and each tank, you know, from 300 was middle, and then the 100-gallon tanks were the smaller ones.
So the parts per million because of the volume.
It was diluted enough that those guys didn't die.
Mm-hmm.
However, every single brood after that, the fish were deformed. The babies, the fry, they'd always have deformed batches, eye popping out, missing a gill, plate, so just the red gills were out, multiple fins, some really strange stuff. When I filed that complaint, inspector from the Department of Ag came in, and she kept stepping outside the room and getting on the phone with a gentleman I later found out was Glenn Sahara, who is from the Big Island, and he is some type of DOE inspector, along a colleague of Ann Cam's.
Ann Cam being the Department of Ag Chemical or Pesticide Specialist Inspector.
Here on island.
Yeah.
Here on island. I don't have anything personal against the woman. She seems like a genuine woman.
Sounds like a competent individual.
I believe so at the time, and
maybe a little overworked and under-supported?
Well, I'll tell you know, I don't want to jump all over the place, but this whole idea that we're underfunded and we're understaffed doesn't fly with me.
Mm.
You know, if I say there's a bank robbery going on over there's a crime, you're going to go take care of it. And that's what occurred here. That it wasn't like they had to go put inspectors out and find what was going on.
Mm.
There were people saying, you know, this is what's happening to us. Adults are having these manifestations of organophosphate insecticide poisoning, chlorinesterase inhibitors, and imagine, you know, my body weight, comparatively to children mm-hmm. who are having all of the
same
symptoms.
Same exposure level.
Correct, right. Correct. So I had prepared those fish for Ann Cam, had a couple in Ziploc bags, put some in the fridge, wasn't sure, had even frozen some just to cover the whole gamut,
sure.
So whatever had happened. They never took any fish, they never took any water samples, and it was just a quick write-up. Mm-hmm. They, in fact, had a comment from a DJ from here, Adam Askiss or something.
Askwith,
yeah. And he never saw the site, never came down and... You know, saw my filtration, anything, and said that it was such and such, and they accepted that third party, that it was okay, you mm-hmm. know, and that moved on, and that was 2004. Monsanto, I guess, was smarter than Syngenta because they held it on. They stopped spraying in that field almost immediately, and gave up that field. The field then went.
Tell me how close, and sorry to interrupt, but how close is this field to your school, to your office, or your classrooms?
If you draw a line on Google Earth from the, you know, they say they had a buffer area, you know, according to the label. But if you draw a line from Google Earth to the field where they were growing, it's about 100 feet. About 100 feet.
100 feet.
A little bit less than a football field.
Mm-hmm.
There's some, you know, some hedgerow between, but even that was cleared out during our most extreme acute incident.
Mm-hmm. And this is also right in town.
Well, I, you know, Waimea Canyon School is actually on the edge of...
Okay, that's right.
It's the outside edge of Waimea on the western border.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually the furthest western middle school in the United States, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
But that field was fallow from 04 to 06, and from 06 on, there were multiple incidents. So we had the first incident in November 06... And then the most acute incident occurred at our school in January 08. But what many people don't know is that between 06 and 08, there were multiple calls to Department of Ag, to Department of Health. There were multiple what we call now spikes of illness indicative of exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There were days that when they were applying pesticide on that field that we could feel the mist on our skin. The reaction of these chlorinesterase and these inhibitors, organophosphates and chlorpyrifos, it's horrific. And I for the children, I just really couldn't understand, you know, the reaction. When you start this, you know, I'm not an activist. I've never been an activist. I'm an educator. And when I started this, and particularly with the aquaculture and the fish, you're very naive to think, well, I'm going to call up this department and it's going to get taken care of. These guys are wrong. They did something wrong. I never in my wildest dreams would believe that what occurred. And even the state study, is quite a debacle. Right in the first part of the state study, they say that the field was infested with stinkweed, and they keep calling it stinkweed throughout. This is a scientific study.
Right.
It's Cleome gyandra is the scientific name of this plant, and locally it's wild spider flower. But they, you know, continually refer to it in that study as stinkweed. And they say that the field was infested, where we have video evidence that that field was fallow. There was nothing on it. Because when they do use the glyphosate Roundup on the field, nothing else grows, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to come up unless it is, in fact, a GE. One of the interesting sidelines as project director for Malohia Group is that people contact me. And fear is a real thing. If you work for these companies, you sign a disclosure, you know, you will not state anything afterwards, and they make it clear they will ruin you. They will take everything you own and destroy you. So people cannot just come out and say what's going on. One of the whisperers said to me is that the wild spider flower is a nitrogen enricher, and that it's a GE crop, and that we're actually planting it intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
During the study period, we have evidence of them actually doing that, of planting it, almost trying to recreate some sort of response from children, and then be able to say,
see,
it was the stinkweed, it was the Cleome gyandra. It didn't happen. It didn't happen because that plan had been out there for as long as I've been at the school. Many people that are horse riders, they ride through it in the fields. They're very familiar with it. There are some individuals that do have acute allergies to any kind of plant, and they might have certain symptoms that are very similar. It's very difficult because the physical manifestations of pesticide poisoning do mimic a lot of things you might see in a middle school. Flu-like symptoms, kind of acting a little crazy, you know, dizziness. It's very hot on the west side. Oh, you're drinking enough water. Headache was probably the most profound. It would start with a very serious headache, muscle ache, hypertension, all of those things. Now, because it would occur on 2006, we started doing some research, started looking at some stuff, and found this here, that children are at greater risk of pesticide exposure for a number of reasons. Children's internal organs are still developing and maturing. Their metabolic and immune systems provide less natural protection than those of an adult. There are critical periods in human development when exposure to a toxin can permanently alter the way an individual's biological system operates. Now, if that occurs when you are at the developmental reproductive age, you know, these chemicals are switching certain switches in your body as you're growing. And we do not know what's going to happen in the future for those children.
Mm-hmm.
We have within that time frame from 2006 to 2008, there were approximately 36 teachers hired. Also within that period, 23 of them left. 11 of them will go on record and say it was solely because they didn't want to get poisoned. They didn't want to, they were concerned about the pesticide. We have two women teachers who, unfortunately, they had babies with special needs who left the school out of concern and subsequently had children with special needs, sadly.
Mm-hmm. So this issue, I think that, you know, you mentioned it earlier that it was one of the initiatives that Councilmember Mel Raposo took upon to find some funds to assist the state agency. The Department of Health conducted this air quality sample?
No, that was with Department of Ag. The Department of Health, I don't know who they are. I don't know where they are.
Mm-hmm. Non-players.
It seems that way.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, from, you know, I'm not an investigator. I'm not a scientist. Becoming so angry at the fact that you know, I actually had conversations with many of these companies' head guys. I would call up and tell them, drift is occurring. You guys are spraying out in the field. The initial response was, no, we're not. And in order to clarify who was spraying out there, we had to call the land company, Kikyola Land Company, and say, who was leasing this field that we were later to find out is called Field 809? And it turned out it was Syngenta. So then we call back Syngenta, and the guy's like, oh, okay, well, we'll contact that operator. And this is the same person that told me that, you know, not an hour earlier, that they weren't even spraying. So it was always that, I can attest as a first person witness that every single time we called them with concerns, that when they were spraying, they never stopped until they were done. They would never stop spraying the field until they were complete. You know, spraying their whatever their regiment was, then they would stop.
It seems like there's, you know, like we said, 7 years ago.
Yeah, after the 04 complaint to DOA, and then the field went follow, we had those subsequent incidents, those spikes. And in 2007, excuse me, I filed another complaint, this time with the EPA.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got a response from them. A Pamela Cooper from EPA Region 9 Pesticide Office. I did receive a reply from an Eileen Bolkin of the EPA, and she referred me to Pamela Cooper. I never heard from them. I never met Pamela Cooper. I've never had any contact whatsoever. Again, as project director and this listening box of people whispering, I had a gentleman approach me at the beach, and he said, you know, you're Howard Hurst, the guy from the school, and you write that blog. And I said, yes. And this couple years later, he said, wow, you know, I was on the plane flying back from California, and I was sitting next to this woman, and we started chatting, and she said that she was with the EPA and that she was coming to Kauai to do an investigation. I never met her. I believe she might have met with then Senator Hoosier. I don't have much details on that. However, this guy was telling me that he got into it with the woman, you know, to the point where he was very much angered at the fact that she had already finished her investigation before she even landed. That she had told him, oh, yeah, it was that weed, and all the kids got panicky, and everyone just, you know, panicked. And
overreacted.
Overreacted. This is the EPA investigator. Now, I'm not sure if she was here to investigate our case, because there were fines levied that same year against some of these seed companies. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if many of your listeners are aware, but these seed companies have been fined multiple times on this island for breaching certain regulations and labels.
Well, I imagine that's one of those things that they suggest is a fact or evidence that they're heavily regulated and that the laws are being enforced.
Well, you repeatedly hear that the label is the law. The label is the law. And to kind of shift off just a bit, from 3170, one of the things that we were successful with was they had to put a 3x5 card on the fields when they sprayed, and they have to say when the re-entry period is and what that pesticide is.
3x5, 3 feet by 5 feet?
No, 3 inches. It's an index card, and most times the signs turn towards the field, so you can't see it from the road. And
that's the public notice.
That's the public notice. Right. Yeah. So
I would hope that, you know, somebody on the council, you know, is listening to think about, like, okay, so the absurdity of that. What we can do better than a 3x5 index card on a windswept chain link fence or hogwire fence.
Well, actually, it's a plastic little square sign right into the dirt, pushed in. You know, it could be covered with weeds. You'll see them. They're red. They uh-huh. use the red index card.
Okay, because red is that international symbol for peligroso.
I guess, or they got them on sale at Walmart. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and it faces inwards towards their
right,
plots.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
How are we supposed to read that?
It's very difficult. I had to use binoculars to read the ones that I did. This is out of Pulahali now.
Howard, are you open for a phone call?
Just, I want to finish my thought before I get sidetracked.
Sure.
And I am kind of jumping around right now. But out at Pulahali, if I could just read, I looked up those pesticides that they had said they were spraying. And one of them, ground and surface water concerns. The next one, potential leaching through soil into groundwater under certain conditions in agricultural use. Use of this chemical in areas where soils are permeable, particularly where the water table is shallow, may result in groundwater contamination. During those years, 2006 to 2008, there were days where if you drove out to Pulahali, it was just a big lake.
We had plenty of water.
Yeah, those fields completely flooded out, mm-hmm. and the open ditches. Another one, ground and surface water concerns. Another one, due to toxicity to fish and aquatic organisms. These are all restricted-use pesticides, which means that only companies can get them. You can't spray them in your backyard.
Right. You got to be licensed. You got to have enough training, be able to read a label.
Right. One more here. This product is toxic to fish. Do not apply directly to water or in areas where surface water is present. Drift and runoff from treated areas may be hazardous to aquatic organisms. This product is highly toxic to fish and wildlife and bees. Drift and runoff from treated areas may be hazardous to aquatic organisms. I consider Pulahali heaven on earth, and it's whale breeding grounds right mm-hmm. off of there. I'm an avid fisherman, whipping off the beach, and I remember when I first moved here, you'd always go up there and catch, and there's very few fish there. There's been days where I paddle out up there, and we call them bumbling bees, that the beach is covered in bees that are not dead yet, but they're just
not zonked. Healthy bees.
Not at all. They're bumbling bees. And I've heard, oh, well, there's this, you know, they have a parasite, and they have a this, and They're very quick to come up with specious excuses, like mm-hmm. it's a weed. It was my unfortunate experience June, July, in my driving back and forth, I always go out there. I found six dead owls. Four of them were pueo.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to get someone to pick up these carcasses to do some testing.
Some type of testing.
And again, the specious excuse comes up. I'm writing. I'm like, I put that bird in a box. How come it's still out there 2 days later on this pole, this number, this, you know, Mackay side of the highway, everything to try to get people to go and get them. And the answer back was, oh, well, there's a rodent population explosion, and that's why the owls are landing and eating those owls. I went higher up than that gentleman and was told that I was actually sent a PDF from 96 about owl mortality. If you go on Google and you search sick owl syndrome, you'll see that there's actually a syndrome here on Kauai that is being studied. Well, I'm not sure if it's funded or studied, but it's sick owl syndrome, SOS. And the description of exactly what I'm seeing, where we're seeing owls in the daytime flying erratically, barn owls walking down the road at Polo Holly, just waddling down the road, it's sick owl syndrome. And it does state that the sick owl syndrome, one of the causes is pesticide.
Mm-hmm.
However, the state agency, you know, the state agencies, they're continually coming up with it's a weed, it's a rodent explosion, it's all of these other things. When if you look at the MSDS, material safety data sheets, you look at the record, you do just the minimum amount of research, you're going to find that on those material safety data sheets, it's exactly what is being manifested in the individuals that are complaining. Whether it be the acute incidents with children going to the hospital. I believe the number is between 20, 22. We can't really seem to get a good, accurate number, but there were about 10 the first time and 10 the second time. But that doesn't count those children that went home, those children that went to the health room. We're talking hundreds. And we're not that big a school. We're about 400 plus, you know, 450 maybe tops. So, excuse me. So it's not just the West Side. It's not just Mahalapu. They've been fined for over there. It's Molokai. It's Oahu. It's Big Island. It's the mainland. You'll see across the country, people are saying, wait a second, that label, unfortunately, is up to the company's discretion of how they determine if they're following it or not. Polo Holly's loam soil, every single pesticide I just read to you guys, it's all, in my eyes, against the label and impacting heaven on earth.
In a big way. And we're trying to figure out what is that impact. I think, you know, you've hit upon something that, you know, I think the moms across the island have great concerns that are now starting to understand better the significance of buffer zones. And we are getting to the top of the hour, and you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. That's 90.9 FM here on the Hanalei side, 92.7 in the Anahola Moloa area, 91.9 FM island-wide, and 104.7 on Oahu, streaming worldwide at kkcr.org. Also want to let you know that you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, and K284AL in Haleiwa on the beautiful island of Oahu. You're listening to Out of the Box with Tim Kalai in the, what do you call that? The sideline seat there waiting for phone calls.
The
rubber box. We are going to get a couple phone calls here shortly right after the top of the hour. We're going to play some underwriters. We have Dr. Emily Marquez from the Pesticide Action Network of North America joining us. She'll be calling in very shortly. But I do want to play this first to let folks know that this out-of-the-box program is made possible by the good folks at Yee Corp and Associates, as well as Hawaii Life Real Estate. First off, here we go.
Children exposed to pesticides during critical growing years face health issues such as higher incidences of respiratory problems, autism, brain cancer, and these are just the tip of the iceberg. We all suffer from the use of pesticides in our food, our air, water, and our INA. Let's live organic. It's intelligent and safe. A reminder from the Surf Rider Foundation.
Neil Norman and the Hawaii Life Brokerage Ohana proudly supports GMO-free Kauai, agricultural biodiversity, and sustainable farming practices, such as community gardens, food forests, seed saving, and beekeeping. Malama Aina, Hawaii Lifestyle.
Yee Corp and Associates, providing personalized employee benefits and insurance solutions since 1988. A green company in an orange building, 808-245-5384. On the web at yeecorp.com.
There we go. A big mahalos to our underwriters and for your listeners and supporters or memberships, membership supporters. I got to just say thanks to everybody for the love and support of our community radio. I've got a testimony that was I found while I was surfing the internet just recently. Going to play that for a couple minutes and then bring Dr. Emily Marquez from Pesticide Action Network to join the conversation here with Howard Hurst and Jimmy Trujillo with Tim Kalayan Out of the Box. So hold on 1 second. You'll be listening to something that you might have heard already. And it comes up frequently. I got a letter from the editor that echoes something similar to this sentiment being shared by this woman, a mother who is employed by the seed companies. So here we go.
It's me to hear people who support this bill come up here and say the seed industry employees don't give a damn. They act like we do whatever, whenever, however we like. They act like we don't have morals. Like, we don't care about the people on the island. I have 4 kids. I don't care how much this company pays me. I would never put them in danger. Or anybody else's kid, for that matter. This is our island, too. We work on the west side. We live there. We raise our kids there. We send them to those schools. We're not forced to work for the seed industries. We choose to work there. We're proud to work for these companies. Mr. Hooser wrote in his blog, and I quote, "I learned about bullies in high school. You first try to reason with them, perhaps gain friendship and respect. Then you try your best to ignore them and stay out of their way. But when they push you, you push them back. Pretty soon they stop pushing. Well, in my book, bullies push first. So you had pushed us first. That's why we're here. We're not here because we like to hear. You know, like, we get all the things that we like do, but you had pushed us. The companies never pay us for come here and talk in front of you guys.
3 minutes. That's your 3 minutes. You need to summarize.
Okay. I gonna be straight up honest with you guys. I'm a registered voter, but every time come voting time, I always make an excuse of why I'm not gonna vote. But my coworker, my irritating coworker, every year he tell us, you guys gotta vote, you guys gotta vote. 2012, he tell us, see, you guys never vote. Now look, Bynum had win by a little bit, we could have Kipukai. Should have listened to that guy.
Listen, Kauai, aren't you shocked by this? I am. I'm shocked.
There we go. So a little public testimony offered up by an employee of the seed company, a mother who wouldn't want to put her children in harm's way, nor would she want to put anyone else's children in harm's way, and joined here in the booth by Howard Hurst, educator who is, seeing children be put in harm's way.
Again, when you look back in hindsight at how naive I was, we are to what these companies are doing. That woman's emotions are true, are genuine.
Absolutely.
She truly believes what she believes, but she has nothing to do with the spray operation to what's being applied. And this is how this company operates. Many of the people didn't have a choice, that you don't have a choice to not go on the road and hold up that sign. Mm-hmm. You didn't have a choice to not go and testify. So in that respect, I actually saw that testimony of the few that I saw, and was very concerned also over comments calling Gary Hoosier a bully. Gary Hoosier is not a bully. He is someone that has been involved in this issue since the beginning, since 2006. He is someone that has listened and has taken the time to educate himself so that his decisions are informed and accurate. You know, you guys had American Association of Pediatrics, I believe, on the show.
Mm-hmm.
They also testified. These are your children's doctors that are saying that there is a need for disclosure, that there is a need for buffer zones. The only people saying you're going to lose jobs are your boss. It's the company. It's that fear. When I was trying to, we've been meeting with some council members and trying to, again, revisit the story and from a first-person basis, the fear is so palpable. One of the women, a teacher, agreed to come. And, you know, again, the metabolism, where they say that you're, you know, restricted the REL's, Dr. Marquez might be able to help me out with that, brain dead. But anyway, the exposure levels, okay, recommended exposure levels, okay, REL's, that they are set by the government based on testing of animals, and it's an acute exposure. It's not chronic daily exposure of these pesticides, that no one knows what's going to manifest itself in the future. But now we're starting to know that these doctors are starting to see these patterns. And that's how we can address it, that we're not naive and we're not making decisions based on emotions. We're basing it upon informed.
Mm-hmm.
You started the show with Martin Luther King, and it was invigorating because that man gave his life,
mm-hmm,
for his cause. And when this woman, this teacher who I asked to share with Mel Raposo and Nadine Nakamura, she stood in front of me, and the fear in her eyes was the same fear that I would see as a lifeguard saving someone.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're swimming up to someone drowning and they're at their most primal state, that's where I saw this woman. And she said to me, and rightly so, and not something that I already haven't thought through myself, but she said, you don't have children here. You don't have family here. And it can happen for generations, the backlash for me speaking out.
Mm.
I believe that also is a very main component of this issue, that do we want corporations here that people cannot exercise their democratic right of free speech,
right,
that this woman should be so fearful, so afraid. And you know, Martin Luther King, she stepped up. She came into that room, and she shared from her heart her feelings. And you know, no names and stuff to respect that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely would like to hear more about your meeting with Councilmember Nadine Nakamura and Mel Raposo, but we are joined on the line by Dr. Emily Marquez. Emily, are you on?
Yes.
Can you hear us? All right.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. If you could just briefly share a little bit about your background so our listeners could know a little bit about what you do for PAN, Pesticide Action Network of North America, PANA, as well as your relationship with Howard. I think there's a little bit of a link here that nobody knows about other than you and Howard.
Sure. So I am a staff scientist at Pesticide Action Network, and I am fairly new to the field of pesticides and nonprofits. I'm trained as a biologist, and being a staff scientist is my first job ever. So I mainly work sort of as a science authority, like a technical authority,
mm-hmm,
sort of evaluating up-and-coming new studies on pesticides and human health and other areas of interest to our organization. And I also do some community-based participatory research where we do air and water monitoring for pesticides. And, I should also say that Pesticide Action Network is basically a policy nonprofit that promotes a fair, safe, and equitable food system. So we work on issues that sort of combat both corporate control of the direction of agriculture in this country, and also look at, you know, human health harms and the impacts that pesticides have on frontline communities, which are agricultural communities, and communities like that in Kauai.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And thanks for the disclosure in regards to your background, your experience. Our last show, Tim and I hosted a young professional, not quite done with his doctorate, working as a consultant with, brought over here from the Hawaii Crop Improvement Association to help promote the GMO or GE technology and to put a little science into that and promote the positive rewards of GE technology and try to, if you will, assure us that technology is fine and that there isn't much that we have to worry about. But we also know that there is an association with GE technology involves a high use of pesticides. Howard was sharing with us earlier that some of the fields on the west side are mainly trials fields that are more experimental in nature, and that closer to the center and the east side of the island, that their parent seeds are being grown there, and maybe less pesticide use. But pesticide use, nonetheless, around our islands and around our children, it's a growing concern. And the Pesticide Action Network has a number of campaigns involved in raising the awareness about pesticide use and what we can do to safeguard our children and safeguard our kupuna, safeguard our communities against accidental exposure, drift, and other negative repercussions of this type of farming. I want to ask why.
Hi, Dr. Marquez.
Why did Howard invite you to join us on the show? And maybe go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I could answer that if you'd like. Part of this coming from a naive, guy that thinks everything is going to work like it's supposed to, you get pissed when it doesn't. And I started writing grants, and I was in a classroom actually before the grant process began, and I asked the students to break up into groups. And I went over to one of the groups, and this young Hawaiian girl said, name of our group is Maluhia Group. And I asked her what that meant, and she said, well, in the Hawaiian language, Maluhia means peaceful passage. She said, a peaceful passage, Mr. Hurst, like a peaceful passage through middle school without getting poisoned by pesticide.
Hmm.
And from the mouth of babes, I just got so angry and started just looking for avenues. Actually, Marie Mogier is the one that brought my attention to PAN and as a resource. And mm-hmm. I wrote a grant from Hawaii People's Fund. And another colleague and I flew over to California and tried to educate ourselves. We went to Berkeley, we went to the 26th National Pesticide Conference, and just tried to soak in as much as we could. As a result of that, I have been working as a volunteer with PAN ever since.
Mm-hmm.
They're my sort of go-to guys, and Emily's the newest champion for me.
Thanks, Emily. And thanks, Howard, for sharing that bit of information. I've met Paul Towers from Pesticide Action Network. He also was here for the a public hearing on the 31st last July, last month. just trying to educate myself. Emily, I'm a beekeeper, and I have appreciated the effort that Pesticide Action Network has been putting out for a number of years, trying to raise the awareness about certain pesticides, whether neonicotinoids or other pesticides that are known bee killers and are known toxic that are being either misused or mislabeled or both. And your network or your organization that you are working for and that you've been blessed to find employment with around the globe is trying to raise the bar in regards to how we do things that aren't going to harm communities and aren't going to harm future generations and aren't going to impact the here and now. What have you been learning in your position? What are some of the things that you could share with our listening audience that might help them understand the issues better?
Sure. Thank you. I think one of the things that was most striking as I started working at PAN, my first project at PAN was sort of interpreting the studies that we looked at for our children's health report, which is called A Generation in Jeopardy. And I think one of the most striking impacts on children's health from pesticides, and these are all public health studies because obviously you can't experiment on humans for ethical reasons, but they are looking at links between pesticide exposure and particularly organophosphate pesticides and particularly chlorpyrifos, which is used on the island. And I think the findings from some of the studies that have been done out of the Columbia University Center for Children's Health Research were really striking because they have described in different studies a 7-point decrease in IQ associated with chlorpyrifos exposure, and this is looking at chlorpyrifos exposure in the cord blood. So that's, you know, at birth, and indicates a prenatal level of exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, there's other ones such as the environment, the home environment did not alter that 7-point decrease. So basically, even if you have a great home environment, mm-hmm. or a highly scored home environment, that would be beneficial to, you know, to raising your IQ or you know, a good nurturing environment, that doesn't alter the 7-point decrease.
So if you get exposed, it doesn't matter what you come from, however the resiliency that your home environment might provide, you're still kind of running at a deficit.
That's what this study indicates.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that hard to pronounce, these pesticides. Can you say it one more time? Chlor.
Sure, chlorpyrifos.
And what is that? What is that?
Chlorpyrifos.
And
so,
what is that used for? Is that an herbicide or is it a pesticide?
It is a pesticide. It's an insecticide,
okay.
And it's from the class of organophosphate pesticides.
Okay, so people would probably use that to kill like roaches, ants. Maybe if they were, you know, brave, they might use it to kill wasps.
Not anymore. Most recently, the EPA banned it for home use, any other than limited agricultural use. I can read here, this is an EPA. EPA is requiring significant reductions in application rates and mandatory buffers around sensitive sites to protect children and other bystanders who live, attend school, play, or otherwise spend time next to sites where chlorpyrifos is applied.
Thanks.
Bad stuff.
It's bad stuff. I mean, it's amazing because I think people just assume that it's a marketable commodity. It's a product that's been okay or approved by the EPA or the USDA for use, and that makes it okay. But it's still bad stuff. We don't know how to deal with it.
Right. I mean, it was used in World War II as a nerve gas. So, and that's how it acts. It acts on the nervous system of insects, or their nervous system to kill them, and it acts on ours. So, I think there's definitely a reason, huge reason for taking caution when we're talking about using something like this that is also, something like chlorpyrifos that's also prone to drift.
Mm-hmm. When I attended the pesticide conference in Berkeley, I had the esteemed honor of meeting Arturo Rodriguez. He's the president of the United Farm Workers Union, and he is the protege of Cesar Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
And he shared with me a UFW saying, the laws in the books are not the laws in the field. So these companies, they're saying the label's the law. Again, the anecdotal I shared about Polahalli. But what we're seeing in the biomonitoring, the response of individuals that are close to these fields, is that it's not good enough. Dr. Marquez, could you touch on the legal petition that PAN's doing as far as chlorpyrifos?
Yes. So basically, a petition was put out, and forgive me if I'm using my legal language wrong because I'm not very good with that, but. There was a petition to protect, to EPA to protect children from pesticide drift, and there were several organizations that signed on to this legal petition, and that was submitted in 2009. But then the one that Howard has talked about most recently, this is basically asking for action now. It was just submitted in July 2013, and you know, the grounds are, well, we've asked EPA to act immediately to protect children from pesticide drift because it is such a huge problem in agricultural areas, and basically the only, I'll just quote straight from this petition, a writ of mandamus is the only remedy that will adequately enforce EPA's duty to respond to this petition. So we're asking for, you know, we're saying basically that the 3.5-year delay in responding to the petition from 2009 is excessive.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you guys, or I should say Pesticide Action Network and other petitioners are prepared to file some type of legal proceeding to force the action of the EPA?
Well, I think we're asking for a response now.
Mm-hmm.
Is the point of this, and then from there we'll see what decision is made, and then we'll determine what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But we're asking for, you know, an immediate response, not simply a, you know, we're looking at it. And then 3 years later, nothing has been, no response has been given.
So. Right. And I think that's something that, you know, I just wanted to share in regards to the group that Howard and his colleagues at the Waimea Canyon Middle School, the school community, the Malohia group. It just was, can I read this, Howard? It just says, Malohia group was formed in response to a complete failure of public agencies responsible for the regulation, monitoring, protection of the public's health and welfare in relation to pesticide use and GMO agriculture on lands adjacent to Waimea Canyon Middle School campus. State agencies have acted in an extemporaneous, insufficient, negligent manner in investigating multiple incidents of pesticide exposure as the result of drift on Waimea Canyon Middle School. Malohia Group seeks legislative action creating pesticide-free buffer zones, strict guidelines for pesticide use, including liability for drift, misuse, and any ill health effects as a result of GMO agriculture. Now, this the formation of your group, you know, Howard, you'd suggested that it was just an ad hoc group, that you guys were trying to get a response from government. And here we are 7 years later with minimal results. 2491 is the closest thing. I know that Senator Hoosier, when he was in the Senate, tried to introduce some legislation, but it was related to buffer zones. Can you guys speak about the issue of buffer zones and what they do and why they are important to protect our children?
I have a letter here from February 16th, 2007. It's to the principal of the school at that time. It was shared with staff. And it's from Doug Tiffany from Syngenta. And I'll just read this paragraph before. As I said, since the 2006 incident, there were multiple spikes, and we kept calling and asking. So they would send over their guys, and they'd come with their notebooks and act like they're concerned. And this was the result of one of those meetings. So out of deep respect for our relationship with the students, teachers, staff, and community, in addition to those procedures already in place, we will take the following extraordinary measures that are above and beyond USDA, EPA, and mainland best practices when spraying on Field 809, which is directly west of WCS. Number one, this is his number one bullet point. If there is a field closer than 660 feet to the school, no spraying will be conducted until after 3:30 p.m. on days that school is in session. Now to me, that tells me that even the industry is in support of a buffer zone around the school.
Recognizes that there's some value of having buffer zones.
And that there is a problem, mm-hmm. that if they're within that distance.
Mm-hmm.
So where he's 160 feet even further than what the 2491 is asking,
okay.
which is 500 feet at
birth. Right.
Speaking of the state studies, the state and county study, the three pesticides, restricted use pesticides that were captured, surprisingly, if you do go to the Malohia site, you'll find pictures of their air catchers, passive, and their high volume one compromised.
Mm-hmm.
That they would put them up and the heavy trades in the morning would just blow them over. So it's really surprising that they found what they did, because during that time it was very heavy rains, and you'll see in the photographs these passive catchers, which has a disc that captures air, the passive ones were over a four-month period. They kind of look like a stainless steel dog bowl or a salad bowl. And if you can imagine that on the roof of a building out in Waimea 24/7 for 4 months, upside down with the rain going in it, and that they were still able to capture, and they'll say, oh, it's below the RELs, but anyone with any kind of, you know, brains upstairs can say, well, with the heat hitting that all day, that's going to degrade the sample. You got it upside down and it's raining. The high volume drift catcher's manual states it's supposed to be upright. They only had it up for a week. Wow, you guys found chlorpyrifos, metachlor, and bifenthrin, all restricted use pesticides.
Now, this is the finding by the Department of Ag in their
the most recent state and county study.
Mm-hmm. The one that this county funded. That we, I think, had a number, the county had a number of issues in regards to what the protocols were, what they were agreeing to sample for, and then what they were going to actually report on. So a number of issues were raised in that report, not all of them favorable.
That report really needs to be investigated further. Part of this effort, you really just want, you wonder, did anybody even read it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the first statement to the field being infested to the fact that Cleome Jandra was found to be insignificant, it's scary. Prior to that, during the incidents when the Department of Ag did come to the school and do swiping samples, they found atrazine. So we'll add that to the list also.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The USDA sampled our water from the water fountains that children drink out of, and they found atrazine as well. Below the MCLs is the drinking measure. And as part of our community-based participatory research project, we were trained by PAN with their drift catcher. It's like a vacuum that sucks air through a glass tube, and you take samples over a period of time. It's very expensive to get the analysis, and our grant was very limited.
Mm-hmm.
And even with those variables, we were able to find chlorpyrifos and ethyl furulin at a home right adjacent our campus. We weren't able to get permission to put the drift catcher on campus, so we found a resident that was supportive of our cause, and we put it in their yard. And just lay people, we're not even scientists, were able to find those as well. So in total, we have five different restricted-use pesticides that have been found on the campus.
Mm-hmm. Now, why was the school reluctant to host one of these drift catchers?
You know, when the first bill, 3170, came around, State Superintendent Pat Hamamoto provided testimony, and she didn't support it. She mm-hmm. was actually against it. I don't know the DOE's current position. I do know that our island CAS complex superintendent is 100% student focused.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did present the state study, he stepped up. And he just, in a bellowing voice, it was a surreal. We were told an hour before that they were going to present the state study to, and by then most of the teachers that were there during the time actually left the school. So it was maybe three of us, and two retirees came back to watch. And Bill Arakaki stood up and he just said, you know what? He goes, there was something going on out there that's not going on out there now, and children aren't getting sick, and we want to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I know where he stands, and very proud to say that he also is very amenable now to, if we can find funding, to possibly looking at that
mm-hmm.
and putting catchers in,
mm-hmm.
which was Dr. Pang, who was also on the show when I came on so many years back.
Dr. Lauren Pang.
That was his recommendation,
mm-hmm.
was to train people on the campus that if they smell, if there's an incident, to then capture, to mm-hmm. be able to capture.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy, if I can interject here, and towards you, Howard, once again, you know, we're on the topic of buffers, you know, dealing around, let's limit it to the school. In your opinion, you know, what would be a safe distance as a buffer? You know, that, I mean, I know what the bill's asking for. I know what this paper that you just read, you know, even their own recommendation from the companies, you know, but what do you personally feel would be a safe distance for the kids in the school itself?
Probably a better question for a scientist. Personally, I have a problem with the Clean Air Act. I have a problem with anybody telling me I can breathe in this amount of pesticide.
That there is a minimal threshold that's acceptable.
And I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, my children, they're breathing fresh air. They're breathing, you know, breathing clean air.
Right. They shouldn't be breathing or drinking any of that stuff.
Correct. And I think that the current science proves that it's a person's metabolism. and how they are impacted by that exposure. It's not based on this arbitrary number from killing rats with this pesticide and saying, well, we can do an algorithm that's going to tell us it'll be safe for everyone.
Right.
Dr. Marquez, have you, in your recent studies, have you found what is kind of the prescription for buffer zones in regards to other municipalities or other areas?
I think buffer zones are definitely a good measure, but as far as let's say we're just saying, well, let's set the bar really high. Are children going to be safe from spray drift or volatilization drift, even if we had a buffer zone of, say, 10 miles or something, you know, that seems like a relatively great distance? And I'd have to say that really isn't the case. But I think buffer zones are definitely a good measure. They have been one, for instance, in Tulare County in California, and that has improved the lives of the residents in Tulare County and other counties in California. And I believe there was, I think Howard told me about a voluntary setback of the company by the in the field by the school, that the company moved some of the plantings back.
When we picketed, when the teachers picketed, it was, and then the union stepped up and they did a temporary restraining order against any kind of agriculture on Field 809. Syngenta finally folded and they ate the crop and they said they're not going to do it anymore. There hasn't been spraying out there since, and people aren't getting sick anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So it's, you know, it's been proven.
It has improved conditions, but I just have an email from, and I won't say who it is because I don't have his permission, but this person is a researcher who studies spray drift for many years, and he contacted PAN because he saw the EPA legal petition that just came out, and he said, he gave me a couple studies after I emailed him back, and he said, these studies demonstrate that there is no time when it is possible to spray without drift. And he was talking about nighttime or daytime. And he also said, significant drift is likely without extensive knowledge of the immediate atmospheric conditions near the ground. So it's as variable as weather, whether or not drift could happen. And I think that's what makes it so dangerous in a place where you've got fields right next to schools.
Right. And I mean, it's sad to think like it's weather dependent.
Right.
Whether or not it's going to blow hard, we don't know.
Yeah,
we do have a phone call. Do you guys mind taking one phone call?
If they can just give me two more seconds on that issue.
Go ahead.
Because speaking of the drift and the distance, when we reviewed the state study, in fact, when we reviewed the Department of Ag study for incidents at our school and Kekaha, there is wind data that shows on fields more Malka past 809, were sprayed with chlorpyrifos at the same time as Field 809, and this is the 25th, 08, was our most acute incident. And the wind data shows the wind switching at the moment that we had children and everyone just expressing these symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
That field is greater than 500 feet away. So it's really hard to gauge how much.
Right.
How far?
What's an appropriate number?
But 500 is a good place to start.
Yeah.
You know, the fact it would cover the field by our school, 809, and to do the same for Kekaha would really help them out this growing season.
Here we go. We're going to take a phone call. Caller, you're on the air live with Dr. Emily Marquez from Pesticide Action Network and Howard Hurst from Malahia Group.
Great. Thank you. First, a comment. I wonder if some of the local folks who are working, and of course we all need a job, but do they really understand how they're really cutting off their nose to spite their face? They're compromising their health. I mean, in my value system, I'd rather sleep on the beach than be exposed and continue this tremendous danger to the children and the adults on our island. And then the question I have for the doctor is, could she speak to the issue of hormone disruption from the herbicides and pesticides?
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Good. Emily, are you open to taking that question?
So I studied endocrine disruption or hormone disruption in graduate school and a little as an undergraduate also. So, I mean, one key pesticide that a lot of people are talking about is atrazine, which was banned in the European Union in 2003 because it was impossible to keep it out of drinking water supplies at a level that was acceptable in Europe. So we know that atrazine is present in drinking water, and we know that it's present in the drinking water on Kauai because there are records from the testing that has been done by the county and including in Waimea Middle School.
So that's fact. That's for the record.
That is accessible online. You can get the documents. So I think atrazine is, it's been documented that it is a gonadotoxin, and that means that it, in males, and that means that it impacts male gonadal development. And this has been demonstrated in all the vertebrate classes. So I'm talking about birds, fish, mammals, and amphibians. I feel like I'm missing one. Reptiles.
Bees?
Okay, so then the thing about atrazine, we have some data on birth defects and connections between birth defects and amounts of atrazine in surface water, but there's been enough evidence to my mind that this is a serious matter whether or not atrazine is in water at levels at or above what EPA says is safe. And I personally do not want to be drinking it. And I think that, you know, the questions that have been raised by a number of researchers about atrazine, something that acts at low doses, which is, by the way, I mean, I should say atrazine is a chemical that acts at low doses to cause impacts on our endocrine system. That is definitely a reason to you know, be wary of something that contaminates our drinking water so ubiquitously. So I just... that's definitely a key pesticide that that really should be we should treat it with great caution.
Excuse me, Howard. I was wondering, is the DOE doing anything with the drinking water out at your school whatsoever? I mean, do they bring in bottled water for the kids, or you know,
we encourage the children bring bottled water.
But the DOE itself has not acted upon this at all?
I am not privy to their investigation. However, I do know that they sent out people to test the water. When we had a conversation with Joanne Yukimura, she had made the comment that the water department here on Kauai had told her, well, if they found atrazine, the USDA, then they should have tested it. And I said to Ms. Yukimura, I said, well, did the water department test it? And she said, oh, no, they didn't. They never followed up. But I do believe the DOE did some studies. You know, I was in my classroom one day, and these two guys, official-looking guys, I happen to have a water fountain right outside my room, and they were actually out at the water fountain, and they were drinking it. And they were like, do you taste anything? Do you taste anything? Now, I hope that wasn't the extent of their testing, you know, really. But that's a true story. They were what do you think of that taste? You know,
well, I have to share something. I took a tour of the Pioneer Waimea Research Center with Nadine Nakamura and Cindy Goldstein. I had asked, I had my bottle, if I could fill up, and where should I fill up? And I was pretty dry mouth, so I just went straight to the cooler, the water fountain that was right there in the aisleway. And she just made a remark of like, yeah, that water's safe. You can drink that stuff, or you can get that stuff. I think it's all pretty much safe. And, you know, I mean, I'm a little kind of, you know, skeptical about just our municipal water supplies being, I think I share what you guys are talking about. I wouldn't want to drink any of that stuff if I knew it had any trace amounts, acceptable levels or non-acceptable levels. I just have a hard time with it.
There are some concerns that, you know, it's almost like an anti-conspiracy. So they think that all the GMO guys and the PAN guys are in a conspiracy against these companies and they don't believe in science. And it's just not true. Correct. We all are coming around to protect children. That's what's going on. This idea of the caller about, you know, do locals know? I work with a very educated woman whose child goes to Kekaha School and was at Kekaha School when it was evacuated. She brought her child to the emergency room. The doctor, who had minimum background in testing, did no chlorinesterase test, did no blood test, no urine for metabolites, nothing, said, oh, no way, it can't be pesticide. And now we see this Association of American Pediatrics are saying, you know, there's a concern. She's against 2491. So you really, you know, it's not always just the science. I mean, I was shocked myself to find out that here is someone whose child was impacted by it, but it's against 2491. I've been told that, you know, well, we're not going to pass a bill to send a message to India, you know. So it really depends on how people are coming about to the issue. And part of my goal today in coming in is to bring it back to its genesis, which is protecting children from pesticide drift.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that is creating dissension amongst us here on the island, you know, is pitting one against others, you know, neighbors against neighbors, farmers against farmers. It is because it's an absence or it's a failure of government. Our government has, just like in the issue of the super ferry, when people talk about the divisiveness of this issue, is just like the super ferry. It's because government has failed at multiple levels.
Well, how can you have a conscience when you're giving testimony and stating that, you know, it would impact revenue? So inversely, then, that gentleman is okay if they were to spray 2, 3, 4 times as much pesticide so he could make more money. Mm-hmm. And we know... And we know what the outcome of that would be, but that doesn't seem to be a problem. So again, the foisted, specious excuse is that these companies have a playbook, and the next play in their book is going to be personal attacks, and we see it happening against Gary Hoosier, you know, saying that these council hearings are biased and that he's a bully, and unfortunately, I've been subjected to those also.
Mm-hmm.
I just find it shameless that. You know, part of that PR campaign, I'm sure most of your listeners have seen the commercial. And it's the soft music in the background and field workers are working with smiles on their faces and nice clean clothes. And, you know, they're not sweating. And they're saying how GE technology has brought about less pesticide use and we use less water.
Mm-hmm.
That is so blatantly false. If I could again share something, it's known as the dirty little secret. According to Dr. Charles Benbrook's research, Washington State University, GE crops are responsible for the additional use of 527 million pounds of herbicides in the first 16 years of their commercialization. In 2011, GE crops used 20% more pesticide on average than non-GE crops. Most GE seeds are intentionally designed to drive up pesticide use, boosting market share for pesticide industry products. That's what it's about. It's about money.
Well, I think Dr. Marquez, you mentioned chlorophyllous. Thank you. That this was, if you will, mustard gas or a remnant from the World War II stockpiles of munitions. And you know, we had Dr. Vandana Shiva here in January earlier this year that, you know, kind of raised the awareness about the fact that these companies are, you know, old war horses that were in the business for killing and in the business for making chemicals that were designed to annihilate. And the leftovers are now being used to grow food. And it's just really hard for me to understand why that's okay or why we want to support that type of agriculture, why we want to support that type of business practice here in beautiful Kauai.
It is a problem, and I do some international work a little bit, so I get to go to Europe to some UN chemicals meetings. And at a recent one this spring, there were talks given by people from the Food and Agriculture Organization, by FAO, and they were talking about the problem of used pesticide stockpiles. So these were pesticides that were outlawed or, you know, the labels went missing. And they just showed photographs. They were in a country in Russia or in the Russian area, in the area of, you know, what Russia was or the USSR was, and also in Jamaica. And this was only two countries that were giving examples. But this is a worldwide problem. There were photographs of storage rooms that had bags of spilled pesticides in there, and no one knew what they were, and also even if they knew what they were, some of them were outlawed and no longer allowed to be used. So we have this problem that's not sustainable. We're creating chemical stockpiles that, as time goes on and more studies reveal that some of them shouldn't be used, we end up with this backlog of bags of chemicals. Like, where are we going to put them? And one of the solutions in the talk by the Jamaican government representative was they walled off the entire building and made a small, cinder block building that you couldn't walk into. And that was their solution at that time, because no one wants to be the recipient country for mm-hmm. these stocks of pesticides that are obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
And what are we going to do with them?
Right. They're a liability, not an asset.
Right. And I'd also just like to speak for a moment to, the conditions of 2491. This bill isn't necessarily causing a limit to business. And, the problem of pesticide drift aside, I just find it very sad that it could be considered a choice necessarily. That, one of the two biggest things that they're asking for is the spray zones, the buffer zones to protect people's health. And the other one, another major part of it, is the pesticide use reporting. So that's not going to limit the company continuing what they do. And next year, if Bill 2491 passes, I guarantee you those companies will make a profit. They're not going to make, less money just because the bill passes. So I just think, I care about the community, and I want people to be able to feed their families and work their jobs. And I think, this is a really important bill to have passed.
Well, thanks for that. I think a number of folks, listeners out there, share that, and question just the sincerity of, that statement that, this is going to shut down the industry, that there'll be no more ag jobs on the West Side or on Kauai if this bill passes. I want to take a phone call. We have somebody waiting online. Danny, you're coming on board. Nope. Drop that one. There we go. Maybe the next one. Yep. Caller, you're on the air? Nope. Okay. Phone lines are free right now. I do want to let folks know that in about 20 minutes, less than 20 minutes, less than 15, you're going to hear Uncle Mose is coming in for the Acoustic Luau. I've got a little promo I'm going to run real quick like that.
Hi, this is Mose. Tune into the Acoustic Luau Thursday evenings from 6 to 8 p.m. You won't hear a lot of brand names, but you will hear some darn good contemporary singer-songwriters, along with a wide range of other acoustic music. That's the Acoustic Luau, Thursdays from 6 to 8 p.m., right here on our community radio station, KKCR.
Right on there. Thanks. So we do have another phone caller, and Dr. Emily Marquez, you going to be able to stay on for a little bit longer, or do you have to leave soon?
Oh, no, I definitely can.
Terrific. So, are you there, caller?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, I had a question I want to ask.
I was researching the water quality on Kauai, and then I also went to check the water quality on Oahu, and what I discovered was that the water on Oahu is greatly contaminated from the past pesticide and herbicide use from the sugar cane and the pineapple fields. So I'm glad I'm not over there drinking their water. So I just think it's sort of disingenuous not to... I wasn't at the meeting, unfortunately, but the thing is, when we have these Superfund cleanup sites on the old sugar cane sites on Kauai, where we're dealing with mercury and other toxins, why this can't be put in context with the present practice. And then my question for the doctor is there anything on a personal level to mitigate the effect of the exposure to these toxins? Like in my own health regimen for the last couple of years, I've been using chlorella and spirulina. Would these elements mitigate the effects of these toxins?
I really don't know the answer to that. I do know an activated carbon filter for your drinking water
can take
out a lot of contaminants. But I can't speak to that. And hopefully you have a doctor, an MD doctor, who can speak to that. But
not really. But I just take my own responsibility. And I think that the most incredible thing is Syngenta, you know, the pesticide that they sprayed on the field next to the Waimea school, they're prohibited from using that pesticide in the Syngenta's own home of Switzerland. Now, isn't that interesting?
Right. That the atrazine that was banned in the EU that also also addressed atrazine in Switzerland, which is Syngenta's home.
And then here it is. We're so aghast at the chemical warfare in the people in Syria, whereas we're using chemical warfare here on Kauai. Correct. I mean, what's the difference?
Well, when I see on the news those children crying and putting things over their face, it's something that I've experienced.
But I mean, the long-term consequences could be just as severe. You know?
Yeah, that's one of the issues.
That's one of my concerns. Thank you.
Thank you for posing the question and making the comments.
On that caller's point, the resulting increase of pesticide use placed the burden of increased costs and health risks on farmers and local communities.
Thank you. Right on. So we're just getting to the tail end of our show. I want to just say mahalo to Dr. Emily Marquez from the Pesticide Action Network of North America, joining us here with Howard Hurst from Alohia Group, a teacher at Waimea Canyon Middle School, there at the site where a lot of this issues with the bill, pesticide drift, disclosure, buffer zones. I mean, we don't have to get into the GM technology debate. That science part is going to be discussed for a long time. But the pesticide information that we're getting, the data suggests that we're not doing a good job managing this, whether it's the bees are being affected by it and we don't know what's the cause of it.
And Jimmy, on the GE side, industry is starting to pay attention. You got Post cereals, you know, all free high fructose. You got Yoplait yogurt. You know, companies are turning. They're like, we're out of here. You know, Jimmy, you started the program with Martin Luther King's March on Washington. Mm-hmm. And we had the march down in Poipu, and there's been some really amazing, amazing people that I've gotten to meet through this process. And I'd like to share a little blurb here on environmental injustice and racism. This comes from the Environmental Racism and Bias Methods of Risk Assessment. Environmental injustice and racism occur when policymakers violate rights to free informed consent or equal treatment in citing decisions. As it turns out, 50% of Asian Pacific Islanders and Native Americans are living in communities with one or more abandoned or uncontrolled toxic waste sites. But also, environmental racism and injustice occurs when risk assessors use biased scientific methods whose policy consequences de facto result in unjustified discrimination against people of color and socioeconomic disadvantaged groups. That's what's going on this island.
Mm.
That's what's going on in Hawaii.
Yes. You know, like you said, it's not just on Kauai. You know, we've got this on Molokai. We've got issues on the Big Island that they're dealing with. You got issues on Oahu. You know, you mentioned the march. You know, in Koloa, you mentioned the 50th anniversary of the march in Washington. This coming up on Sunday, the 8th of September at Vidina Stadium, 12 p.m. noon. Right, Vidina Stadium, there where the county fair was just this weekend, will be the Mana March to protect what we love, with folks from around the island coming together to show support for Bill 2491, to support the notion that pesticides and people need to be monitored and regulated and enforced. The label is the law. We need to be holding folks accountable. And Bill 2491 attempts to address some of these issues regarding pesticides, regarding protections. Our buffer zones are I think we're all in agreement that we need to have them. Maybe we're not in agreement of exactly where, you know, but I think close to kupuna, close to kids, close to families, that close to the aquatic species, that's not acceptable to have this type of chemical applications going on. So be there on the 8th of September, if you choose, 12 o'clock is the start. Going to be walking from Vidina down Rice Street all the way to County Council Chambers to show support, solidarity for the people inundated by pesticides, the children and the future generations. This is an opportunity to support both the bill and the people. It's a powerful statement when we all get together and do things like we did in Koloa, like we did 7 years ago.
Super fair.
There you go.
Hey, you know, Jimmy,
go ahead, Tim.
We had a caller that also didn't want to go on the air, but would like to basically get some information, and it was pertaining to, I believe, a law that was just recently passed, you know, concerning these corporations and how the liability issue on how they can't be held liable, you know, in regards to this. And does Howard have any information in regards to that particular law that has just been passed? And how does that pan out, you know, working with the kids or working with, you know, us, the private citizen?
I'm not a lawyer. I really couldn't touch on that. But they are, as I said, following a playbook that they have. They're not just fake farmers. They have sociologists, they have their own RNs that test, they have their own people that go into a community and they play on cultural nuances. Mm. So they're also in the legislature and they're fighting hard. It's been, since the beginning, it's been one after another trying to just stop, you know, freedom of, they wanted to pass a law that you can't take pictures, you know, of mm-hmm. their crops. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. You know, as an indication of their arrogance, the industry's arrogance and omnipotence, traditionally teachers, the first week of school, particularly on the west side, we have, it's very hot. We only have one building with an air conditioning. It's the library. And Kekaha Elementary is the same thing. It's the only building is AC. And that first week's, last week in July, first week in August, it was when the big testimony was going on. Mm-hmm. I believe it was the 29th, 7/29. Well, I'm not sure by whose permission. You know, everyone's afraid of losing a job, but yet there's been such infrastructure building going on by Dow and Syngenta. I mean, Syngenta changed the road so that you can get into their place easier.
Mm-hmm.
Dow just did some landscaping and put up a main entrance sign that costs more than my yearly salary. During the first week of school at Kekaha, even with all of their facilities and all of their money, for some reason Syngenta decided to have a meeting in Kekaha Elementary's library. So teachers were displaced and they did not, they had to have their meetings in hot classrooms while they're planning for the school year. And Syngenta, as it was expressed to me, a group of mainland gentlemen were in there. And they were doing flip charts and planning for the future. And their efforts were so important that at the end of the day, they took their flip charts and everything and threw them in the rubbish can, just threw everything out. And as I stated earlier, people contact me and I came by these documents. They gave me these documents. And I'd like to share a picture that was sent to me of one of their flip charts. It's sort of looking towards the future. They have 7/29/2018, and it says that atrazine found to prevent cancer in conjunction with Syngenta trait Duracade. Duracade is a rootworm trait, something like their BT corn. Atrazine, we know, is a carcinogen. So this is their idea of humor. Syngenta corn breeder Ben Howley wins Nobel Prize, and behind the prize, it's money, money, money. And this is a room of people that are displacing teachers that should be planning for children, and that's their idea of hard work. And I really feel it's just a slap in the face that it epitomizes the arrogance that they go into the legislature, they just write their own laws, they do their own whatever. They do what they like, cuz can. And Bill 2491 is our opportunity to show them that you can't, okay? You can't poison children.
There we go. Dr. Emily Marquez, thank you for joining us from California. Look forward to talking with you more about this in the future. Howard Hirst, thank you for joining us here on Out of the Box.
Thanks for having me again, Jimmy.
Mose, thanks for being patient. We're going really close to the over the box schedule here. And folks who tried to get in, sorry that we couldn't fit your commentary in. Please call in on the next Out of the Box show. That'll be next Thursday with Jonathan Jay and Dave Giroux. Also, just to let you know that The Pool A will start at 11:30 for the Mana March. 12 o'clock we'll begin the March of Edina Stadium. We'll conclude at the county council chambers, the historic county courthouse. There will be music, entertainment, speakers, Walter Rite, Dustin Barca, John Cruz, or Kepa Cruz, sorry. And then also coming up next Tuesday night, I believe, is going to be a presentation, Dr. Huber at Kauai Community College. Stay tuned for Moses Acoustic Luau coming up right here very shortly after this Out of the Box show. Mahalo for joining us. Maria, I love you.
I hope this is a faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims' pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring. And when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."